Welcome to this Square Root Day edition of Main Street. Square root, you ask? Well, it's 9, 3 squared, 16, 4 squared, 25, 5 squared, and it only happens once a century, and it happens to be today. And we are glad that you are with us on Main Street. Coming up in the second half today, a big lineup. We'll hear from Dr. Tom Ezern in another of his Plainsfolk essays, a bad water problem in an Illinois community, jumping mice in North Dakota, and our weekly segment, Our Living Lands. Main Street begins on this Tuesday with a Conversations on Healthcare. Dr. Michael Osterholm and co-author Mark Olshaker join Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner to discuss vaccine policy, public trust, and their new book, The Big One.
Well, Dr. Osterholm, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you, Mark and Margaret. It's always good to be with you.
And Mark, thank you for joining us for the first time.
Thank you for having us both.
You know, you have co-authored a new book and well focused on that in a minute. But let's start with Dr. Osterholm. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has just announced a vaccine skeptic to head its COVID-19 working group. His name is Retsef Levy from MIT. I'm wondering if you could give our listeners your reaction.
Well, I think Mark and Margaret both, it's fair to say that we're in free fall. I've never in my 50 years in public health experienced anything like this in terms of the threat to good public health. This particular group under Mr. Kennedy's leadership really is doing everything they can to take away vaccines from the public, to destroy any confidence that we have in them. And this is obviously an issue for today where we are still talking about diseases like COVID, influenza, and so forth. But also it's all about the future and preparing for the next pandemic, which is what our book is about. And that's why I say over and over again that these are dangerous decisions that have been made, and we will pay a big price for them as we are now in preparedness free fall.
Yeah, I think what Mike says is absolutely true. When we set out to write this book in the midst of the COVID pandemic, we wanted to prepare people for what they could expect from what we called the big one, and COVID was definitely not the big one. We set out a scenario of what it would be like. We thought we had descriptions, we had suggestions, we had takeaways. What we didn't realize at the time was that our book would kind of be an absolute counterpoint to what is going on today, what Mike calls free fall. It never occurred to us that we would say, well, you know what you read in our book? That's not what's happening, but that's what needs to happen.
What's on your mind that leads you to say that this is the most dangerous decision at this moment in time, even looking back over the last 50 years? What are you thinking is likely to happen from it?
Without any doubt, one of the most, if maybe not the most important tool in public health has been vaccines. The millions and millions of lives saved over the last century from vaccines has been just simply remarkable. Well, now we have a Secretary of Health and Human Services that is in every way an anti-vaccine advocate, someone who has talked about how these vaccines poison people, talked about the fact that those individuals who are promoting vaccines are basically criminals. When you understand that, you realize that for the first time in all of our public health careers, we are seeing someone who is their whole point is to basically take the vaccine enterprise down and out. And it's not based on science. You know, last week I was asked repeatedly by the media after the American Academy of Pediatrics came out with their recommendations for vaccination for COVID, which were counter to what the ACIP and HHS said. And I said to the media folks, I said, you know, you're getting the questions wrong here. You shouldn't be asking about what was different about AAP. You should be asking yourself why, for every of all the public health organizations in the world, of all the governments in the world who are all on the same page, how could HHS be so far off? What's wrong with them? And it's because we have a zealot who basically is all about trying to take vaccines away from us. And so that is dangerous. That is just out and out dangerous. It's not based on science. It's not even based on a political philosophy. It's just based on the idea that because he can take these vaccines down, he's going to.
What's happened in the society that's brought us to this place where science has been sort of pushed off to the side?
Well, I think, Mark, I'm not sure science has been pushed off to the side for the majority of people. Surely it has for some in a big way. But when you actually survey the public and look at who do they trust, what do they trust, there still is substantial trust in public health. The challenge we have is that when you have a megaphone the size of one that the secretary now has, it does start to basically drown out science as you've just described it. But I think we have to continue to remember that the science is on our side. The Vaccine Integrity Project, this operation that we created within CIDRAP, has actually been an effort to evaluate all the information that's come forward on vaccines for COVID, influenza, and RSV since the last time the ACIP evaluated them. We presented those data in public last week. It was an exhaustive study looking at over 17,000 abstracts, then taking the papers from there using a very detailed protocol approach. And we reaffirmed over and over again what ACIP had affirmed prior to this time. So, so for some of the vaccines, it was 2 years ago since it was looked at. But based on what they had looked at before, our results were consistent. The science is there. Last week, when Mr. Kennedy announced why certain vaccines wouldn't be available, he basically said because they were not safe relative to the benefits. Then you had the director of the NIH coming out a week later indicating, no, actually it was because of the fact that people didn't trust the vaccines. But when you actually go into that trust issue and look at it carefully, what you see is, in fact, that a lot of the distrust has been sown by the very people who are supposed to be promoting vaccines. That does cut big, and particularly in Republican circles. And that's an unfortunate commentary when you think about in the COVID pandemic, the number of excess deaths that occurred among red states and specifically people who are registered Republicans versus others. So I don't disagree about the trust, but I think for a majority of people, they're waiting for and wanting the kind of accurate information that says these vaccines can still save lives. Think about this. Last year, 265 kids in this country died from influenza, and needlessly, in the sense of what vaccines could have done to prevent those illnesses. We do have a lot of work to do. But in fact, I think the bottom line message is there still is that opportunity to provide that work.
Mark, I think you bring up a very important point, which was when we published our last book, Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs in 2017, I think we got a lot of things right. In fact, our chapter on coronavirus was called SARS and MERS, Harbingers of Things to Come. Mm-hmm. The one thing we, and I stand by almost everything we wrote in the book today, the one thing we got wrong, and we got wrong by omission rather than commission, was it never occurred to us that in the case of a major public health crisis, a pandemic, if you will, that health would become politicized. It never occurred to us that people wouldn't do everything they could to follow the latest science and do what they could to save their own families, to save lives, and save their communities.
Well, I want to pick up on that thread because I think one of the things that I've always counted on is that parents will try and do right by their children in terms of protecting them, and school vaccines and immunizations have been a big part of it.
Margaret, let me just interrupt to say that we write about the Salk and Sabin polio vaccines, which came out in the mid-1950s. And parents lined up around the block overnight to get their children vaccinated against this scourge. I think one of the things that Mike has been dealing with in his work all this time is the challenges of success. Vaccines have been so successful in preventing horrible diseases that people have started taking them for granted and just criticizing around the edges. Well, it's not as good as we wanted it to be, or it's not, you know, we can still transmit and things like that. But we've taken for granted how much vaccines have changed our lives.
Well, I think the part of that is kind of the line that's been drawn around schools and vaccines and children having to get those vaccines, mm-hmm. right? I think the blue form is kind of like ingrained in my brain. Mm-hmm. You have to demonstrate that you've had all your vaccines, but we're below the target rate of 95%, I understand, and have been for a couple of years. And last year, it actually was at 93%. And I wonder what your take is as you look across the country about schools, what they're doing to try and maintain that vaccine rate and the counterpoint, some of the pressure that's coming at them as we've seen federally for schools that have only very narrow exemptions and otherwise absolutely require the vaccines.
Yeah. Well, first of all, schools are not a monolithic entity. They're very, very different depending on the community, the population that goes to those schools, and their access to healthcare all make for very different. For example, in Minnesota, we unfortunately are below that line of we'd like to see for vaccination rates for what we call herd immunity activity around measles. At about 87% of our school children are vaccinated coming into schools. But we have schools here in the Twin Cities metropolitan area where only 40% of the kids are vaccinated. So it's kind of like saying your head's in the freezer, your feet are in the oven, and average your temperature's just right. And so what we have to also understand is how do we reach out to those sources of illness in the community that are coming from schools with only 40% of the people vaccinated. And that's a huge challenge. We can't ignore that. We don't understand completely why these occur relative to social media, cultural issues, but it is a huge challenge.
Well, our head's been in the oven, in the refrigerator, Margaret. We're in 150 schools. Schools just started to launch here, and we see that wide disparity all across our state as we deliver care. But Dr. Osterholm, you've recently launched something that might really be integral to improving the situation around vaccine acceptance. It's called the Vaccine Integrity Project. I'm wondering if you could describe that work.
Yeah. Well, again, as I noted previously, this was an effort to basically bring up to date the scientific conclusions about vaccines, their effectiveness, their safety, availability, based on what the ACIP used to do, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. And they used to provide this information to the major medical societies that would then in turn make recommendations also for vaccinations. So American Academy of Pediatrics would do that for children. ACOG, OBGYN group would do that for pregnant women. The Infectious Disease Society of America would do it for adults and particularly immune compromised individuals. And so all of these medical societies have played a huge role in coming up with the recommendations. Now they don't have the data to do that because the ACIP no longer provides that comprehensive review and update. So we did that. We evaluated over 17,000 abstracts, numerous papers in a very systematic way, even measuring potential bias for or against effectiveness, and presented those data to the societies for their use. We're not in ourselves making recommendations. We're just trying to provide the kind of homework that is a very heavy lift for these organizations so that can support good science-based approaches. And I think that's when we look at what we're trying to do right now with our book, it's the same thing. We're just trying to basically provide the kind of information that can be the tool to say, what do we need to do for the future to protect ourselves against, for example, a big one?
Well, Mark, you and Dr. Osterholm previously wrote Deadliest Enemy, about killer germs. Mm-hmm. That was a page-turner. But the new book is just out, and it's called The Big One. And it describes a coronavirus more infectious and deadlier than COVID. Tell us about the scenario that you laid out in that book.
Well, first of all, can I just add, Mark, I want to just add a context to this, Margaret. At the time that we wrote this chapter, we anticipated that what we were later able to find would happen. And what do I mean? Well, when you look at SARS and MERS, these were two viruses in 2003 with SARS, 2012 emerged with MERS. And in those instances, fortunately, they were not that highly infectious. We did have some super spreaders that caused some large concentrations of cases in very select areas, but we were able to bring those under control using good public health approaches. But what was notable is anywhere from 15 to 35% of the people who got one of those two viruses died. Well, along comes COVID, where it's much more highly infectious, spreading like influenza. And on top of that, though, only about 1 to 1.5% of the people died from this. What would happen if you kind of had a mixture of both SARS, MERS, and COVID? And now we've actually uncovered viruses in the last 6 months in China in caves with bats, where in fact, the receptor sites for the virus getting into the human lung cell is very much akin to what we see with COVID, meaning it could be highly infectious, but having the same kind of genetic component to it that is very much like what we saw with SARS and MERS in terms of ability to cause serious illness. Imagine if COVID, instead of killing 1.5% of the people, killed 35% of the people. What would that be like? That's not science fiction anymore. That is not somebody just grandstanding. That's saying, are we ready for this or not? And of course, we're not.
You know, Margaret, we're not futurists and we don't claim to be. We just look at the evidence and see what's there. What we did is we started out by saying, all right, what's the worst public health disaster that we can remember? Certainly the 1918 flu. Mm-hmm. And then when we started doing research, we realized, you know, we're no better off today to combat something like this than we were 100 odd years ago. We've got 4 or 5 times the world's population. We've got airplanes that can get anywhere in the world in a few hours. We've got 1 billion international crossings a year. We're cutting back on natural reservoirs of forests and things like that. And we've got huge impoverished megacities with no sanitation or health supplies. And we realized this is a big problem. And if something like that were to happen again, what would it be like? So we started out with that scenario and we used it as a takeoff point for each of the key points we wanted to get across, whether it's how the viruses work, what viruses are likely to cause such a pandemic, how do you communicate properly to get the science across in a way that's both realistic but also understandable? How do you deal with public policy? Do mandates work or not work, and under what circumstances? So that's what we tried to come up with in this book. And unfortunately, it's getting progressively frightening. I mean, this really is a not if but when situation. And the point that we've tried to get across over and over again is arguably these microbes present a far greater threat to our way of life and survival than any human enemy or opponent possibly could. And yet, we don't treat them the same way. We don't treat our public health establishment the way we treat our defense establishment. If we did, we would be much better prepared. We need a military model for developing the armamentarium that we need to fight what will inevitably happen. It may be next year. It may not be for 10 or 20 years, but it will happen. And
I will say,
Mike says we're going in the wrong direction.
Right. I think our listeners, Margaret, would be asking to have our guests tell us, when's it going to happen and how do I prepare? Right. So we've answered the sort of first one. We don't know, but is there any sort of guess here that might help them? And can an individual really be prepared, or is this a really societal response that's needed?
Well, let me give you the 2-point answer on this, and that is the fact that the one tool that will help us get through a pandemic with most impact is an effective vaccine that's readily available at the time that the pandemic emerges. Right now, if we were to see a major influenza pandemic emerge, we'd be in big trouble. Because, in fact, our global capacity to make influenza vaccine is only enough vaccine in about a year to 15 months to vaccinate 1/4 of the world's population. And that's largely because we're still using embryated chicken eggs to grow the virus in, much like we did 50 years ago. Well, mRNA technology really offered what we believe was a really important opportunity to use that vaccine against influenza. And that's what this research that was recently cut out was all about, was to make certain that we had flu vaccine manufacturing capacity, which could have given us enough vaccine likely even within a year for the whole world. That whole program just got scrubbed. You know, right now, we took away the very best tool that we possibly had for an influenza pandemic. So tell me now, what are all the public going to do if we had an influenza pandemic? What could we tell them would be coming to save them? Now, there'll be other countries in the world that will continue to work on mRNA technology. They will have vaccines. They will be at the front of the line. We will now be at the back of the line, unlike what happened in 2020. And this is going to be, I think, a really major legacy issue for whoever's responsible for taking down the kind of research and manufacturing quality activities for these vaccines.
You have Mr. Levy who's saying, you know, let's stop the mRNA vaccine now, right? Didn't he just publish something recently about stopping its usage?
Yeah. You know, Mark, this is, again, is an example of if you and I were on a jet plane about to take off and there happened to be 100 mechanics right there by the plane. And you and I asked the mechanics, is this plane safe to fly from this place to someplace else? And 97 of the 100 said, no, you wouldn't get me on that plane. Two of them said, well, I don't know. And the third one of the 100 said, absolutely, I'd fly on this, no problem. Would you fly on that plane? Well, what we're doing is we're letting that one mechanic dictate what we think about vaccines in this country because he or she says this. No, the 97 of the mechanics say, don't get on that plane. That's what public health is saying, not just in the United States, but around the world. We are so off base with what we're dealing with. This is not science. It's science fiction that they're dealing with. And we just have to understand that. And that's why we have to continue to do what we can to assure that these vaccines are available. We will pay a price. You know, as the old Oilfram commercial of a couple of decades once said, you know, you can pay me now or you'll pay me later. And we will pay a hell of a price later if we allow this kind of activity, taking away our vaccine research and development and manufacturing before a pandemic.
Those vaccines were not produced at NIH. They were produced in the private pharmaceutical labs. Why or how can the private pharmaceutical industry step up to continue the research and to have the means of production of the next vaccines that we need? We seem to be almost disproportionately focused, given the reality that we currently have, not happy with the
federal government. Let me just say, what company is going to put forth billions of dollars to build capacity that might never get used and therefore basically be a totally lost investment? This is where government partnerships have always been very important. And you can say, well, wouldn't it be great if they'd take these issues on? You know, they're not charities. Not that they don't make lots of money, not that they surely wouldn't profit by selling vaccines during a pandemic, but they're not going to invest in those. This is the reality of it. We have to be prepared to invest in what will protect the public. And that's going to mean having capacity to manufacture these vaccines. But you can't even deal with that until you have the research and development done to actually show that these vaccines can be effective, that they are safe. And that's what right now we're just trying to do that much of it. And that's what's been cut off.
Imagine if a company like General Electric said, all right, let's build a fleet of submarines and then we'll try to sell them to the government because at some point they're going to need them. It doesn't work that way. You can't do it that way. You don't build an aircraft carrier for $3 billion and then say, all right, maybe we'll have a government take it over. You have to have this collaboration between government and private industry to make it work. And they both have to be focused on the same vision. And right now we're not.
Mark, let's get back to the book, which covers how airborne viruses spread and why we still seem to get this wrong. What exactly are we misunderstanding? How is artificial intelligence, we have to get that in every show that we're in, adding to this confusion?
Well, first of all, from what I understand about artificial intelligence, which is limited, it really does try to please. So it will give you the answers you are looking for. And from my experience over many years of writing, if you look hard enough, you will get the answers you seek, whether they're the right answers or the wrong answers. But you know, one of the problems is that we're just not focused on this. I mean, we just don't get it.
Nobody talks about rubella. Everybody talks about the measles vaccine and how it might harm your children, and nobody talks about rubella.
Well, you know, first of all, let me just maybe make a minor addition to your question here and say I've been talking about it a lot. I never talk about measles without also talking about the potential for rubella. And we have seen rubella cases show up in Europe, where there are a higher number of individuals not vaccinated than we have here in the United States. And so this is a serious challenge. And anyone who remembers German measles, rubella, and the impact that that had on the unborn child is absolutely stunningly remarkable and scary. So we do have to understand that. And I think that it's not just about measles. Measles is also a highly infectious virus, which makes it more likely to transmit. But if you don't get a measles shot, you're not getting a rubella shot either, or a mumps shot. Okay, because remember, it's MMR. And so all three of them are there. I think the one thing we also want to emphasize, though, as bad as things are in this country with regard to vaccines, we're in better shape than a lot of places. Think of this. We're now at a little over 1,200 cases of measles this year in the United States with a population of 340 million. Mm-hmm. Canada, which only has 40 million, is over 3,200 cases of measles this year. So this is a global issue of importance. And of course, measles virus will jump across the border in one plane ride. So it is important what happens around the world. And we have our hands full right now, and we have to keep our eye on rubella as well as measles. It's a big issue.
Let me get a last question in. You guys are a dynamic duo. Tell us what the chemistry is that makes all these books you're writing so compelling.
Well, I think what we realized was what we're writing about is high technological drama, and we wanted to keep it that way. So, you know, from my background as a novelist and a journalist, the question, what happens next, is really important, and that's what we tried to convey. So this really is in addition to a dire warning, this is also a thriller and a mystery story. And we used all of Mike's talents and experience to make that work.
And I can fortunately say that I get the opportunity to work with my twin brother of a different mother. And that surely has also been a wonderful opportunity.
But we want to thank you, Dr. Osterholm and Mark Olshaker, for joining us. Take care, everybody, and be well.
That was Dr. Michael Osterholm and Mark Olshaker on a Conversations on Healthcare, reminding us that science, vaccines, and preparation remain vital tools for our future. Still to come on Main Street, a plain spoke essay, a look at a water crisis in an Illinois town, jumping mice in North Dakota, and Our Living Lands. It's our weekly Tuesday edition. Stay with us. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In this Plainsfolk essay by Dr. Tom Ezern, he previews the 1880s across the Dakota prairies, where few words inspired more dread than hydrophobia, the old name for rabies. It was a disease wrapped in mystery and rumor, spawning desperate cures, fearful communities, and even folklore of mercy killings. Today, Dr. Ezern revisits the time when fear of the disease sometimes seemed more powerful than the disease itself.
In May 1886, a physician in Watertown, Dakota Territory, was bitten by what press reports said was a mad dog. The doctor immediately booked steamship passage, gone to Paris, the paper said, to consult Pasteur. Just a year previous, 1885, Louis Pasteur had announced discovery of his somewhat tortuous vaccination procedure for rabies, a disease that was known to most people at the time as hydrophobia, meaning fear of water, a confusing term in two ways. First, the observed fear of water was a symptom, not a disease. The disease is rabies. Second, a creature afflicted with rabies did not fear water. It thirsted, but it could not drink on account of throat spasms. The term hydrophobia is intriguing, too, in that it appears to be the first use of the Latin suffix phobia attached in usage to the specific object of fear. Nowadays, we have so many fears, we had to invent terms like agoraphobia and pantophobia to cover them all. Plains folk of the 19th century had more specific fears. It might even be said they had a phobia of hydrophobia. In the late 19th century, few people had the awareness or the means to run to Pasteur if they thought they had been bitten by a rabid animal. Some would have the bite cauterized, burned with an iron, in the belief that might kill the infection, painful at best. Others sought out a madstone, a smooth stone, a concretion that originated in the stomach of a deer. The finder, or someone acquiring the stone from the finder, would become a known personage who would apply it to animal bites. It would adhere to the bite until it fell off, then be soaked in warm milk and reapplied until it no longer stuck. I once held a historic madstone in my hands in Hutchinson, Kansas, but I know of no madstone or any documentation of one in North Dakota. Nor have I found evidence of the most radical recourse, euthanasia, mercy killing, as applied to a human in our territory. There was a celebrated, possibly legendary case in Texas of a man tied to a tree and left to die. The classic homesteading memoir from Kansas Sod and Stubble, includes an episode when men of the settlement are called out to deal with a rabid boy become dangerous. When Henry the Homesteader comes home and is asked what happened, he will only say, "Smothered in his own bed, Dick." Like that phrase, the whole experience with hydrophobia on the plains is full of ambivalences, fertile ground for folklore, fear, and rumor. There were frequent rabies scares in particular localities, some of which became more broadly regional. Reactions were rapid. Community alarms, contract tracing of a sort, killing of dogs and other animals suspected of infection. There were voices raised against fears that seemed excessive, some even suggesting there was no such disease as rabies. It was all imagined. Newspapers on the prairies published interviews with the superintendent of the American Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals in New York City, denouncing hydrophobia quacks. "It's easy to cure a disease that never existed," he said. Newspapers in Alaska reported that indeed the disease was unknown there. There was a gender aspect to the situation, too. The Ladies' Home Journal, arguing that women especially were inclined to panic about this bugaboo, appealed to country editors to stop publishing local reports of hydrophobia. The editors did not kill the news, however. I'll be back to tell you about it.
That was another of Dr. Tom Easern's Plainsfolk essay, reminding us that the story of hydrophobia on the prairies reminds us that the frontier was much about managing fear as it was about taming the land. Rabies was rare, but the phobia of hydrophobia ran deep, shaping local lore, treatments, and community life.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving over 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from coal, natural gas, wind, solar, and hydro.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We look at how toxic bacteria can shut down the water supply for one Midwestern town. In Mattoon, Illinois, harmful algae blooms turned tap water dangerous, forcing residents to rely on trucked-in drinking water and leaving businesses scrambling during one of the town's biggest summer festivals.
An annual festival in Mattoon that circles around bagels was a little different this year. There was still live music and plenty of carnival rides, as well as bagels, of course, provided by a local commercial bakery. But this year, the water had to be trucked in. Food vendor Chris Walton says it didn't help that city officials went back and forth on a do-not-drink order.
As a matter of fact, some of our machines have all been sanitized, and then, of course, they put the order back in. So everything we did was for naught now, so we're going to have to re-sanitize everything, you know, that we're not using right now.
Elsewhere in Mattoon, the do-not-drink order forced restaurants to close or make do with paper plates and bottled water. Algal blooms in the city's two reservoirs had sent toxins into the tap water. Bacteria in the blooms produced dangerous levels of microcystins, a neurotoxin that can sicken and even kill people who drink, cook, or wash with it. Robert Hirschfeld is director of water policy with the Illinois-based environmental group Prairie Rivers Network. He says nitrogen and phosphorus runoff from farms are often behind the blooms.
I wouldn't say that there were no harmful algal blooms 100 years ago, but as we've tracked them, the frequency and severity has increased in recent years.
In 2023, Guthrie, Oklahoma had to switch its water source after an algal bloom affected one of its reservoirs. A massive bloom in Lake Erie left residents of Toledo, Ohio, unable to use their water for days in 2014. Environmental scientist Gregory Dick, who studies algal blooms at the University of Michigan, says the toxins from such blooms make water unusable.
That affects not just people's drinking water, but their ability to take medicines, their ability to shower, their ability to cook. So it really disrupted lives for residents, for businesses, for hospitals.
Toledo installed expensive sensors and carbon filtration to help make sure its water supply is clean. Such solutions will likely be needed in more towns and cities throughout the Midwest, Dick says, as algal blooms don't appear to be slowing down. But Keith Lofton, who studies algal blooms at the U.S. Geological Survey's Kansas Water Science Center, says it's difficult to know if the blooms have actually gotten worse.
Many claim that blooms are becoming more frequent, greater in magnitude, duration, and spatial extent. However, largely we lack robust, consistently collected data sets throughout modern times to make large sweeping national and global statements.
Back in Mattoon, the city council voted this summer to spend roughly $300,000 to buy a new reservoir water pump and spray algicide to control the algal blooms. City manager Kyle Gill says eventually they'll need to dredge their reservoirs to get rid of fertilizer-embedded silt.
We'll spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in the short term, but most of the long-term solutions are millions of dollars.
At the moment, Mattoon's water supply is okay. But after a new algal bloom appeared in Lake Mattoon in August, that reservoir's beach was closed for much of the month. I'm Jim Meadows, Harvest Public Media.
This story was produced in partnership with Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains. It reports on food systems, agriculture, and rural issues. Main Street continues on this Tuesday. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Have you ever been startled on a prairie walk by a tiny creature leaping like a miniature kangaroo? You may have just encountered one of North Dakota's lesser-known residents, the jumping mouse, as Chuck Lura explains in this natural North Dakota.
What was that? That was my first thought when many years ago, while walking through some low prairie, something that I could only describe as a mouse-sized kangaroo took three big leaps out of the grass in front of me. I was to learn later that it was a jumping mouse. It might surprise you, but North Dakota is home to a couple of species of what are commonly known as jumping mice. Vernon Bailey in his Biological Survey of North Dakota from 1926 described their jumping behavior accurately, and I quote, "When startled, they go bounding away with long jumps, suggesting frogs, and usually make two or three leaps before stopping to see if they are pursued," unquote. He goes on to say that they are most often disturbed when in their nests. Robert Seabloom in his Mammals of North Dakota notes two species of jumping mice native to North Dakota. The most common is the meadow jumping mouse, which ranges over much of Canada in the United States, roughly east of a line from North Dakota to Kansas. It's more common than one might think in North Dakota, and may be found across the state in grasslands, as well as wooded habitats where it prefers some of the moister sites. The meadow jumping mouse is small, with a length of about 8 inches, including the tail, which approaches 5 inches long. Those measurements are correct. The tail is longer than the body. And as one might expect, they have long hind legs, which enables them to jump 6 feet or so, often several times, and not in a straight line. Like many other mice, their diet is variable, includes insects such as beetles and caterpillars, as well as seeds. Their breeding season runs from May to September, during which time 2 to 3 litters of around 7 young are produced. When winter comes around, they hibernate, usually in underground nests. The other jumping mouse in North Dakota is the western jumping mouse. This species has a smaller distribution, reported only in the Red River Valley, Cheyenne National Grasslands, and a few northern counties. The two species are quite similar in looks and habitat affinities, which makes them hard to distinguish. So if you're out walking some moist grasslands or woodlands, you too may encounter this interesting mouse. I've put links to more information on jumping mice along with the text of this natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
This is Bird Note. At a mountain summit in Vermont, among gnarled and stunted spruce and fir, dawn breaks with this unique sound. The swirling serenade, of a Bicknell's thrush. Corduroy brown above and pale below, with messy spots on its breast, the thrush isn't really known for its good looks. It's known for scarcity and promiscuity. Unlike most songbirds, the female thrush establishes a territory and then mates with males that happen by. She then lays eggs that have been fertilized by multiple different males. Many of those males will stick around and help feed the young, even if they are not their own. Bicknell's thrushes are exceedingly rare, and they face an uncertain future with climate change and habitat loss. Yet each year, this little songbird makes the long journey from the Caribbean islands to the forests of the northeastern coasts of North America to make a call that a few of us may be lucky enough to hear in person. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein. Support for BirdNote is provided by Sarah Murner and Craig McKibben from Seattle, Washington, and generous listeners around the world.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. For millennia, indigenous people have intentionally set fires to care for the land. Colonization and policy largely put an end to those practices, though the tradition endured. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Murphy Woodhouse reports, a new law in California has opened the door to restore cultural burning, a potential model for the rest of the West.
On a late June afternoon, in the remote northern California town of Orleans, Michael Sanchez hops into a wildland fire truck. He's the prescribed fire and fuel specialist for the Karuk tribe and helps organize their cultural burns, including those in his neighborhood that day.
And yeah, one of the burns is my house, so I've been kind of taking the main lead on preparing that.
While small, they represent a major step forward in the tribe's long-standing effort to promote cultural burning. It's the fruit of years of advocacy and collaboration with federal agencies and nonprofits to bring down barriers to putting good fire on the ground. In 2022, the state established a claims fund for when fires set by landowners and tribes cause damage, reducing financial risk for burners and the public. Then last fall, Senate Bill 310 was unanimously approved. It allows tribes to enter into agreements with the state and bypass regulatory requirements to burn. Karuk leaders called it a chance to atone for efforts to stamp out burning well into the 20th century. Sanchez says 310 has made burning much simpler. He drives past an orange sign notifying drivers of the cultural burn.
That's one of the requirements, and then also a 72-hour notification to local agencies, Forest Service.
There are a few other steps, like written permission from landowners, but that's about it.
Yep, so yeah, this is my place here.
The first burn of the day is in an adjoining yard. Using lighters, a Karuk trio sets the dry grass and leaves ablaze, checking it with a simple hose. Bill Tripp, the tribe's natural resources director, says the fires help protect homes.
Well, today we're just trying to get rid of this stuff that's going to catch an ember and start a spot fire in the summer.
Bill was taught to burn as a young boy by his great-grandmother, bearer of a time immemorial tradition of using fire for ceremonies in the care of key animal and plant species, like hazel, used for basketry. Tripp is the only tribal council recognized practitioner able to oversee burns, but his people created a process to train more. He and others see these small projects as a way to rebuild skills and a sense of setting fires as a common practice.
I would like to see 10 houses just get together, have a barbecue, and get it all burnt in a 2-3 day window.
In 2023, a major federal commission said that beneficial fire, which includes cultural and prescribed burning, is essential to restoring ecosystem health and reducing wildfire risk.
We don't need to reinvent the wheel here.
Dylan Cruz is the president of Sustainable Northwest. Inspired by reforms in California, the nonprofit helped push for a claims fund in Washington and Oregon. While rare, intentional burns can escape control and cause significant harm.
We want to do more cultural burning, but the biggest limiting factor or concerns is around liability issues.
He encourages other Western states to work with tribal nations to remove barriers to cultural burning. In a grass field on the outskirts of Orleans, a small team is burning a strip of black around the edge.
Once we get a black line around it, then we can let it rip.
That's Bill's brother, Jacob Tripp. Trailing behind the slow-marching flames, a group of teenagers, seasonal workers for the Natural Resources Department, sprays the edges with bladder bags. Think water guns attached to water-filled backpacks. It's Karuk Youth Council Secretary Chloe King's first burn.
like there's a lot of adrenaline going through me right now, but I definitely feel like I'm doing the like best thing for the land right now.
Blackline complete, the burner's light strips through the interior. Unsatisfied with the speed of progress, Jacob pulls out a propane torch. When he gets back to the first turn of the blackline, the flames intensify and then tear through the remaining dry grass. Boxed in by black, the flames quickly diminish.
This is awesome. That was crazy.
Chloe has caught the firebug. Here's Bill.
A really important part of our Cudahy educational process is to make sure that we're putting fire in the hands of our children at a young age and teaching them how to be responsible with it.
Just like his great-grandmother did with him. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Murphy Woodhouse.
Tune in next week to hear more about the Crook's burning practices and how communities across the country could learn from them. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Quantic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 16th. As the Northern Pacific Railway made its way across Dakota Territory, it eventually reached what is now known as Billings County. The first siding there was called Fogarty, named for a railroad contractor. In 1883, it was renamed Summit, a fitting name, as the railroad was at its highest point before descending into the Badlands. The site was renamed once again when it was platted on this date in 1909, becoming known as Fryburg. This time, it was named in honor of Civil War General James Barnett Fry. General Fry was a little-known but highly respected military officer. A West Point graduate, he served in the Mexican-American War. In 1861, he was assigned to a unit that provided protection during Abraham Lincoln's inauguration. Later, he served as Chief of Staff, first to General McDowell, then to General Buell. In 1863, he was appointed Provost Marshal General, putting him in close contact with President Lincoln. Fry impressed nearly everyone who worked with him. He was recommended to Lincoln by none other than General Ulysses S. Grant. Presidential aide John Hay, who interacted with many notable figures, once called Fry the firmest and soundest man I meet. Fry's duties included enforcing the draft, recruiting black soldiers, highly controversial work at the time, but he carried out his responsibilities with efficiency and impartiality. Even those who didn't like him admitted a certain admiration for the businesslike way he approached his role. General Fry continued his military service until 1881. After retiring, he turned to writing. He passed away in 1894. Fryburg received a post office in 1911, and a newspaper soon followed when Gerald P. Nye began publishing the Fryburg Pioneer. Nye would later become a United States Senator. In the 1950s, Fryburg saw a surge of activity and prosperity during the oil boom. And here's the curious part of the story. General Fry had no known connection to North Dakota. Perhaps someone who served with him in the Army or worked with him in Washington thought he was worthy of remembrance. In any case, the town named for him grew, though few today remember who he was. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that wraps up this Tuesday edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, Sarah Nagel, the Director of Business Development for the Bowman County Development Corporation, stops by to talk about the Fusion Conference that begins on Thursday in Bowman. It's designed to focus on building workforce leadership. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.